This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. After more than 100 days in office, Donald Trump has finally left the country. Over the weekend, he embarked on a multi-nation trip, starting with Saudi Arabia and then heading to Israel. After that, he will make stops in Belgium, Italy, and the Vatican. It was strange that Trump's first foreign stop was Saudi Arabia, given his overt hostility to Islam and Muslims. Stranger still was Trump's announced formation of the Global Center for Combating Extremist Ideology, which is to be housed in Saudi Arabia. He also announced a partnership between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia called the Terrorist Financing Targeting Center. Saudi Arabia has long been linked to the financing of anti-U.S. extremist groups. Trump also boasted of a major $110 billion arms deal with the Saudis, continuing his predecessor Obama's legacy. And coinciding with his trip was a joint Saudi-UAE $100 million donation to a center for women's empowerment that Ivanka Trump helped to start. Trump had excoriated Hillary Clinton for her foundation's acceptance of Saudi donations. My guest is Rahul Mahajan. He is the author of two books, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He's also a PhD student in sociology at the University of Wisconsin, and he is the U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire correspondent for this program. Welcome back to the show, Rahul.
Great to be with you again, Sonali.
So why do you think Saudi Arabia was the first location that Trump would step into outside of the United States? It's clear he's reluctant to leave the country, but why Saudi Arabia?
Well, I can only speculate, and I think it blindsided all of us. But you note that in the Muslim ban, or whatever exactly the Trump wanted to call its various iterations, Saudi Arabia was left out. Saudi Arabia is obviously, it's the source of 15 of the 19 9/11 hijackers and of a great many other international jihadis, although these days it's been, I think, eclipsed by other countries like Tunisia. But still, Saudi Arabia was left completely out of it. And there are two reasons that I think overlap. One is, of course, the longstanding U.S. strategic partnership with Saudi Arabia, the way that it has sort of built not only Middle East hegemony, but also for a long time influence over the global oil trade around its relationship with Saudi Arabia. And the second, of course, is that Trump has his own ventures in Saudi Arabia, and I would never discount extreme venality as one of his motives. Also, it gives him the ability to trumpet his supposed ability as a deal maker with numbers like 110 billion and 350 billion being thrown around. You know, some people might think that is going to amount to real money. So I think that's the reason, and you can see in the way he talked about it that every other consideration that got him here has been sort of jettisoned along the way, at least with regard to that trip.
Let's actually play a clip from the speech that he gave in Saudi Arabia. Much was made ahead of this trip of what he would say in his speech. Here is an excerpt from the early part of his speech where he claims that there's a new optimism sweeping over the United States before announcing the Saudi arms deal.
For Americans, this is a very exciting time. A new spirit of optimism is sweeping our country. In just a few months, we have created almost 1 million new jobs, added over $3 trillion in new value, lifted the burdens on American industry, and made record investments in our military that will protect the safety of our people and enhance the security of our wonderful friends and allies, many of whom are here today. Now, there is even more blessed news that I am pleased to share with you. My meetings with King Salman, the Crown Prince, and the Deputy Crown Prince have been filled with great warmth, goodwill, and tremendous cooperation. Yesterday, we signed historic agreements with the kingdom that will invest almost $400 billion in our two countries and create many hundreds of thousands of jobs in America and Saudi Arabia. This landmark agreement includes the announcement of a $110 billion Saudi-funded defense purchase. And we will be sure to help our Saudi friends to get a good deal from our great American defense companies, the greatest anywhere in the world. This agreement will help the Saudi military to take a far greater role in security and operations having to do with security.
And that is Donald Trump speaking in Saudi Arabia over the weekend. Rahul, let's start with the first part of what he just said there. It seemed strange to me that he was sort of boasting to Saudi Arabia about how great the U.S. economy is doing. He said a new spirit of optimism is sweeping our country. Polls suggest it's quite the opposite. A lot of people are quite depressed about the Trump presidency, but he's boasted about having created a million new jobs, over $3 trillion of new value, etc. Why did he have to make that case to the Saudis?
I think that that's probably just the part and parcel of Trump's general desire to boast about everything. I think he would say the same thing no matter who he was talking to. Right. And I guess it's worth pointing out that those claims are pretty nonsensical. I mean, first of all, yes, it is true that the economy is adding jobs, but it's adding jobs at exactly the pace that was set by the Obama recovery. And obviously, a few months into his term, it's hard even for Trump to seriously try to claim that it has something to do with any initiatives of his own. So probably in Trump's mind, the unemployment rate was 42% when he was campaigning, and now it's 4.5%. But the truth is it went down from, let's say, 4.7 to 4.5 as a continuation of the recovery. And the optimism that I see in this country is pretty much all confined to Wall Street.
The other thing that he then, of course, talked about was the investment. He said we signed historic agreements with the kingdom that will invest almost $400 billion in our two countries. He veered off script for a second. Rahul, I don't know if anyone's noticed this. The official transcript of his speech that was released said that this $400 billion investment in our two countries will create many thousands of jobs in America and Saudi Arabia. When he gave the speech, that number, thousands of jobs, became hundreds of thousands of jobs, which is just bizarre to me. So what does this mean? What does the Saudi-U.S. investment that will create hundreds of thousands of jobs in these two countries mean? Do we have any details of this investment plan?
I haven't seen very many details as yet. Let's start with the arms deal. So, I mean, according to a recent study, over the course of the Obama administration, about $115 billion in arms deals were inked with Saudi Arabia, including in 1 year, 2011, kind of an important year, $33 billion, according to the Congressional Research Service. So it's a continuation of that. It is an expansion in some way. So one of the interesting components of the new arms deal is a plan to have 150 Black Hawk helicopters actually assembled in Saudi Arabia, which is going to create 450 jobs in Saudi Arabia, or as Trump would call it, 4.5 million. And it's interesting in a couple ways. One is it's a massive expansion of the helicopter deals under the Obama administration. And also, I mean, if you know anything about the Saudi economy, everything that gets built by the 10 million strong foreign national labor force, not by Saudis. In terms of the broader investments, one of the big components is Aramco inviting investments from Western oil companies. And that's, again, that is something that's been in the cards for a couple of years, ever since the sort of shakeups in the monarchy and the who is actually in power in Saudi Arabia, with the ascent of King Salman and a succession of new crown princes. They have been talking about inviting private investment into Saudi oil for quite some time now.
Now, on the issue of the arms deal, the $110 billion arms deal that Trump has promised the Saudis he'll get a very good deal from U.S. defense companies for. This is a country that has not engaged in very serious military exercises until Yemen. It has been one of the biggest U.S. weapons buyers for a long time. And now, and over the past few years, it has, with U.S. advice and with the collaboration with the United Arab Emirates, has waged a very brutal war in Yemen. I understand that there were protests in Yemen during Trump's visit. But is this arms deal yet another green light from the U.S. that it's okay for the Saudis to do what they're doing in Yemen?
So, Sonali, I'll agree that I think that the Yemen war is the first really major Saudi military effort in recent memory, but I think I actually traced the shift back to 2011 itself, and the fact that as the Arab uprisings were happening and the Obama administration was reeling, trying to figure out which side it should be on, not wanting to be on the wrong side of history, but also not wanting to see the rise of regimes that were relatively uncontrollable. Basically, they capitulated to Saudi on Bahrain. You know, the Shia majority was in very active protest. There are estimates that, you know, more than half of the Shia population came out to some protests, numbers unheard of. And the United States allowed Saudi Arabia to go and invade and crush that uprising completely. That was, of course, it had been building ever since the Iraq War, but that was the start of a new Saudi assertiveness and lack of regard for what exactly they think the United States wants. So it's been a new sort of regime in the Middle East since then, and the Yemen war is the result. So Barack Obama, while never taking a strong stance on the Yemen war, did try to put conditionalities on the use of some of the arms. So he actually halted the sale of $400 million of precision weapons because he knew that Saudis were going to use them in Yemen in an indiscriminate way, even in an even more indiscriminate way than the United States does. You know, of the 10,000 people killed, estimates are that at least 4,000 are non-combatants in Yemen. So, and that's all gone now. Trump is saying, you have the arms, do what you like with them. I mean, it's certainly in technical violation of the Arms Export Control Act, but most U.S. arms dealing is.
Let's play another excerpt from the speech that Trump gave. This one focused on Iran, which is, of course, a really important aspect of Trump's foreign policy as well. And Iran is has been one of the main reasons that the Saudis are fighting in Yemen, claiming that Iran is a sponsor of terrorism. And Trump seemed to simply echo that line as well, in contradiction to his predecessor Obama, who worked hard to have a warming of relations with Iran. So here's what Trump said about Iran in his Saudi speech.
But no discussion of stamping out this threat would be complete without mentioning the government that gives terrorists all three: safe harbor, financial backing, and the social standing needed for recruitment. It is a regime that is responsible for so much instability in that region. I am speaking, of course, of Iran. From Lebanon to Iraq to Yemen, Iran funds arms and trains terrorists, militias, and other extremist groups that spread destruction and chaos across the region. For decades, Iran has fueled the fires of sectarian conflict and terror. It is a government that speaks openly of mass murder, vowing the destruction of Israel, death to America, and ruin for many leaders and nations in this very room. Among Iran's most tragic and destabilizing interventions, you've seen it in Syria. Bolstered by Iran, Assad has committed unspeakable crimes, and the United States has taken firm action in response to the use of banned chemical weapons by the Assad regime, launching 59 missiles at the Syrian airbase from where that murderous attack originated.
And that is Donald Trump speaking about Iran during his speech in Saudi Arabia, saying that Iran funds, arms, and trains terrorist militias and other extremist groups. He also accused Iran of basically propping up the Assad regime in Syria. This is all, Rahul, happening at the time that Hassan Rouhani won his second term as Iranian president. And it was Rouhani's rule in Iran that also made it easier for Obama to cut a deal with Iran. Is Trump going to undo all the progress on Iran with these words?
I'm not certain. I think that he's had considerably more trouble undoing the nuclear deal than he has on other fronts. And it's true, of course, that the nuclear deal does represent progress in the region. And it's also true that Rouhani's landslide victory is a good sign. But some of what Trump said is actually perfectly accurate. The Assad regime has committed horrible atrocities in Syria, and Iran bears full responsibility for the way in which it has backed the Assad regime directly with Revolutionary Guard people, indirectly with the support of Hezbollah, and with the increasing involvement of Iraqi Shiite militias in the civil war. So,
alongside Russia, of course, right, in terms of responsibility?
Yeah, but I think Iran has been involved there longer and with more people on the ground. I mean, obviously, Russia's air force has made a major difference. But you know, the first foreign element that really helped to keep the tide from turning against Assad was Hezbollah, which started taking an active role in like 2012. So Iran has played a major role in propping up the Assad regime, and it often doesn't get called out for it. But remember, this is in the context where Trump is basically, with his extremely one-sided criticism, he's basically taken a side in what has sadly become the emerging Sunni-Shia, violent conflict that spans much of the Middle East. So he's said nothing about Saudi Arabia except to say that what they're doing in Yemen is great and that he is going to give them lots of arms to do it. He said that Iran is the main and sole source of spreading terror in the region, where in fact there are multiple sources at this point. And he has finally, after taking pretty much the opposite tack during his campaign of saying that he supported Assad and was against the rebel militias, now has switched and said that he is very much against Assad and in favor of the rebel militias. So he's taken a side, and I think to the degree that it represents coherent thought, it seems to reflect the obsessions of one of the people who's supposed to be one of the sane people, the adults on the National Security Council, which is Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense. For some reason, he has an obsession with Iran, you know, much like the kind Netanyahu has had and that some neoconservatives had back when they were in the ascendance. And he thinks he goes so far as to suggest that Iran is more responsible for the emergence of ISIS than countries like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, which have at least had people who are directly or indirectly contributing to it, although I'm not saying that any of these governments actually supported ISIS, which I think is incorrect. But he has basically taken the view of Jim Mattis, which is sort of delusional when it comes to the larger picture. Mm.
Now, what about these centers to combat extremism, et cetera, that Trump has announced? I mean, it seems, as you pointed out, a majority of the 9/11 hijackers were Saudi, but Trump seems to think Saudi Arabia is an appropriate place to set up the Global Center for Combating Extremist Ideology and this joint venture called the Terrorist Financing Targeting Center. I mean, it sounds like a joke.
It's like Chomsky says when people ask him about the war on terrorism, that if you really wanted to make inroads in terrorism, you'd have the United States stop committing it. Similarly, in Saudi Arabia, I mean, the best way to combat violent extremism is for the Saudi government and associated individuals to stop spreading it. Now, it's not true that they directly have tried to prop up either Al-Qaeda or ISIS, but it is true that they have done a great deal to spread ideologies that are highly compatible with that, to send out and fund the sending out of people to fight jihad in foreign lands ever since the 1980s in Afghanistan, at the very least. So if they want to really combat the spread of global extremism, they could start by not doing what they're doing. Although there's been very little about this in the press, my guess is somehow that since it is in Saudi Arabia, it's going to be all about combating Shia extremism, not Sunni extremism. Saudi Arabia already does a good job of combating not just extremism but Shiism, to core in Saudi Arabia. It keeps the Shia population, which is heavily involved in the oil sector, from actually the full expression of their basic, religious ceremonies. So my guess is it'll be just about the Shia.
Also, Ivanka Trump lauding the Saudis for progress on women's rights. And then the UN, I understand, a UN fund on women's empowerment that Ivanka Trump helped to start is accepting a $100 million contribution from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Granted, it's not the Trump Foundation accepting it, but Trump did make a lot of the Clinton Foundation accepting donations from Saudi Arabia, which I thought was actually a legitimate critique. What do you make of this idea of Ivanka Trump pushing for women's rights in Saudi Arabia? There's a lot to unpack there.
There is, and I'm not even sure I want to do it. I mean, when did Ivanka Trump become a legitimate spokeswoman for women's rights anywhere? I mean, if she, with the Saudis, if she really wants to fight for women's rights, she should start by opposing her father mm-hmm. and everything he's doing, and forget about running around the world getting money from people. But the Saudis and other Gulf countries have often engaged in this kind of, you want to call it pink washing, but they do it on a whole bunch of other issues as well. Give a little bit of money to bodies that sound okay or sound international, and then hope that nobody really inquires about what they do in their own countries. I mean, right now in Saudi Arabia, obviously, despite the occasional, over the past 10 or 15 years, the occasional sort of attempt to at least change the situation of women's rights somewhat. So, for example, to hold municipal elections in which women could vote or so on, there's basically been no progress whatsoever. So every time there's some new initiative that gets hailed, whether it's by Ivanka Trump or actually somebody who knows something, it's all just part of a game that people play in order to generate publicity and get money.
Right. If you look at the photographs of Trump visiting Saudi Arabia, there's not a woman in sight. There's a few young girls wearing Saudi national dress. And then there's female members of the Trump administration, which I believe are basically Melania Trump and Ivanka Trump. I really, even on the U.S. side, there's almost no women present. It's just basically this giant festival of masculinity, let's put it that way.
There was that one really major blow struck for women's rights in the Trump tour, and that's that no women were forced to go to a Toby Keith concert. So
let's talk about the Israel trip. So as you and I are speaking right now on Monday, Trump has landed in Israel, has started giving his speeches in Israel. This is, coming at a very interesting time. There's a massive hunger strike by Palestinian political prisoners happening in Israeli prisons. What do you expect U.S.-Israeli relations to, what sort of boost could they get with Trump's visit there? Netanyahu is much happier, it seems, to have Trump in the White House than Obama.
So yes, Netanyahu hated Obama, and the feeling was returned, to say the least. So you know, U.S.-Israel relations during the Obama administration were probably as fraught as they were during the Bush senior administration, even though Obama didn't put anything like the impediments in the way of Israeli activities that Bush senior did. So with Trump, you know, the Israeli right wing, which is now, you know, the group that controls all Israeli policy, has been sort of up and down. They wanted Trump in, but Trump is such a random wild card. They've been able to overlook the strange confluence of extreme anti-Semites and, you know, relatively right-wing Jews in Trump's administration, and chalk it up to the craziness of U.S. politics. But when he talks about Palestine, he's all over the place. So they're very concerned about what he's actually going to do. My guess is that since Trump is, the two things that to remember about Trump when he's jumping into these things, one is he's a total coward. So he will bluster at his big rallies about all kinds of stuff. Then when he's face to face with someone, he doesn't have much to say, and he mostly just sticks on script. And secondly, he's completely ignorant. So every time he jumps into a new issue, he's learning the basics, you know, what other people might learn in elementary school about it. And if he's learning the basics from Netanyahu, my guess is that on this trip, he's going to sound a lot like Netanyahu. Then when he goes back home, who knows what happens. But right now, I think they're very concerned about the occasional statement he's made about deal making and the need to, and the, you know, the great ease with which the Israel-Palestine problem can be solved. And, you know, obviously John Kerry didn't find it so easy during the years he devoted to it, but there's still always concern among the Israeli right that somehow U.S. pressure will be brought to bear to make them negotiate a peace deal.
Right.
Now, in actual fact, they're not going to, no matter how much pressure is brought to bear, but they certainly don't want to feel it.
Now, let's also talk about what Trump was leaving behind in the United States. As he made preparations for his trip, his administration, his extremely young administration, was facing its biggest scandal so far. And use of the word impeachment crossed the lips even of elected officials with this entire Russia business. We've covered all of that on our program, but I'm wondering if you feel that Trump's foreign trips are a good, much hoped for distraction from the Trump administration's perspective, a distraction away from the troubles he's facing at home.
Well, you know, we're seeing multiple distractions right now. First of all, the firing of Comey and the series of bizarre revelations and statements Trump has made about it since then seems to have completely wiped the Republicans' attempts to gut health insurance off the map. So that's one distraction. Then all the fanfare about the Saudi Arabia trip is distracting from the talk of impeachment. But, you know, I think that it's interesting that for a long time, various people talked about impeachment. Michael Moore used to say all the time that Trump was going to be impeached. And, you know, I think it was mostly sort of BS trying to get attention because, of
wishful
course,
thinking,
everybody
maybe?
Knows. I mean, everyone knows the Republicans are a totally corrupt party now and are not going to impeach someone just because they think he committed treason. But given the brazenness with which Trump is trying to basically indict and convict himself, it's become something that's not completely unthinkable. Now, impeachment wouldn't necessarily be good because, you know, then you get Mike Pence and the Republic of Gilead, but it is actually a possibility.
And also, how is his trip to Saudi Arabia, his speech to the heart of the Muslim world, and some of what he has said, how do you think all of that is playing among his supporters? It seems as though Trump could do anything, and there's a certain sector of his supporters that will never stop supporting him. But the Obama administration and the Democrats' allegiance to Saudi Arabia was often a strong right-wing talking point. A lot of people thought that Trump would be able to stand up to the despots in the Muslim world, but here's Trump embracing them.
So a lot of people are just openly hypocritical, and once it's Trump doing the same thing that Obama does, suddenly it'll be a good thing. I mean, look at the shift even among actual politicians like Mitt Romney on things like his own healthcare plan once Obama started trying to implement it on a national scale. So there are a lot of hypocrisy. Now, the true believers among the Trump supporters, which is to say neo-Nazis, the alt-right, people like that, they have been criticizing him virulently for some time now, and they basically think, especially since the cruise missiles sent against Syrian military installations, that that Trump has been swallowed up by what they call the deep state, or what normal people call the state, and is now basically doing exactly the same thing they expect from whatever in their fever dreams the Zionist occupied government or whatever those idiots think the United States government is. So they are very much against him, but that doesn't mean they're going to be for anyone who actually tries to fight him.
Well, Rahul, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We shall see how Trump's visit continues to play out, particularly when he heads to the Vatican, where Pope Francis has been one of his strong critics. Rahul, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Rahul Mahajan is the author of two books, including Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He's a PhD student in sociology at the University of Wisconsin, and he's our U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire correspondent. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.